we welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals. This is our first set of arguments for the new year, 2015, so Happy New Year to everyone as well. We have two cases set on our 10:30 docket, Thayer versus Thayer and Collins versus State. So we will proceed through those two cases one after another. And I believe all parties or their counsel have checked in. And we'll begin with Thayer 2-14044-CV. If the clerk will announce counsel, please. All right. All right, Mr. Michelle.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
We are here today, I think, on an interesting appeal from a divorce action that involved a division of the marital estate and custody and visitation issues with regard to what is now one remaining minor child. I represent Keitha Thayer, who in 2008 was diagnosed with terminal illness arising out of various autoimmune deficiencies. She is continuing this fight to see her child while she is still alive and able. There were issues raised after the divorce was filed about Ms. Thayer's alleged abuse of prescription medications. The presiding judge, Judge Crawford, heard that evidence and awarded Keitha Thayer standard visitation with unsupervised visitation. We fast forward, and that was in 2011, we fast forward to trial in June of 2013. And an overriding issue when child custody is in determination is that it's a rebuttable presumption that it's in the best interest of the child to at least for the parent to have standard possession. That's 153.252. In order for a finding of unfit, the acts must be extreme. That's Allison. The limitations on visitation can't exceed the amount to protect the child. And the trial court is also obligated to minimize the restrictions. As we have pointed out, Judge Crawford was the original judge who recused himself, and then Judge Cleveland was appointed to hear this case. And needless to say, things went downhill for my client after that time. By the time we get to trial, the allegations for limiting my client's visitation was alleged prescription overuse or doc shopping. But however, if you examine the record, and particularly if you examine the appellee's brief, many of the dates and timings and references are obscured, to say the least. They'll make an accusation of something occurring, but there's very little reference to the timing.
Excuse me, what are the terminal illnesses?
The autoimmune diseases.
Which are the terminal ones?
I don't know if that was differentiated, Your Honor. It was testified to by Dr. Lucas that she had scleroderma, Raynaud syndrome, Sjogren's, antimophobolipid syndrome, and mixed connective tissue. Dr. Lucas testified that these were extreme and difficult and painful diagnoses. She has had her fingers amputated, and her blood circulation, she had a severe blood clot in which she almost died from and was...
Okay, but what's the terminal illness?
I don't know if that was identified in the record, Your Honor. Which one
of those... I
don't see
anything I recognize as terminal that would mean somebody has to hurry up and see their children really soon.
We see it throughout the record. The testimony was that she was advised that these were terminal. The other side did not seem to dispute that as well. Likewise, at the trial, the diagnosis was the alleged text message that they characterized as a suicide attempt or statement, I should say. And really, it was just a text that I don't have long, is what the actual quote said, which was a reference to that she doesn't know. Now, whether they are in fact are terminal or are not terminal, that's what she was advised, and that's in the record. Needless to say, Dr. Lucas testified at length that Keith is suffering from debilitating and extremely painful diseases, and the fact that she's able to function and fight and trying to see is that he characterized her as a courageous patient. These allegations of by the time we get to trial in 2013, the allegations are her alleged prescription abuse arise almost 3 years before the trial date. If you go back to the motion to modify the temporary orders where Judge Cleveland took away her standard visitation to 64 hours a month, the allegations were that, which had been around for a long time. These allegations had been around at the first hearing. Nothing new was brought up except that she had passed out at 11:30 at night in January of 2012. No emergency motion was brought. Nothing was done. Nothing was raised. The issue in December of 2011 was that the house was a mess and it was unfit. Nothing was raised. No emergency motion. At trial and the hearing, they thought it was unsafe for her to drive. The testimony was that she had hit a deer. Mark testified he had hit a deer. They live out in the country. Mark had no other evidence of any other accidents of Keitha. When she did this alleged attempted suicide with the texting message that I may not have long, nobody filed an emergency motion. Nobody filed it. Nobody made a 911 call. Of course, Keitha directly conflicted that testimony, said I wasn't trying to kill her. Her mother was there, said she was ironing and taking care of some clothes. But the only objective facts we have are her text and the fact that no actions were taken. Mark filed this motion to modify, to take away Keitha's visitation in March of 2012, based on those allegations, and he denied visitation. Judge Cleveland, Keitha had filed a motion for enforcement at that point. Mark, because these events apparently were so important, he filed a motion to modify to reduce the visitation of Keitha, but he never sent that motion to modify for hearing. If it was such an important issue to protect the children, to take away the visitation of a parent based on alleged allegations from 3 and 4 years ago, and the recent one was because a dirty home 4 months before, an alleged suicide attempt text 2 months before, and you don't even file a motion to set it for hearing. Judge, and this is the real issue, Keitha filed a motion for enforcement because Mark was denying her visitation. And importantly, after these all these events had happened, all these allegations had been out there for years, Mark entered into a Rule 11 agreement agreeing for Keitha to have a week-long spring break visitation.
Aren't parents put at a really disadvantage because it's damned if you do and damned if you don't? If you don't get along and try to give people visitation, then you're dinged for that when you go to trial. If you do, then you get that argument. What's a person to do?
We try those issues all the time, Justice Gabriel. I do a lot of family law cases, and there is a lot of damned if you do and damned if you do. But what you don't do is take the children away and have supervised visitation. She's now down to 8 hours a month.
Well, but...
But no proof.
While you argue that they want to talk about these vague dates and what happened years ago, you don't really address Dr. Bates, who came in and testified that these children have markedly improved since the supervised visitation began. And Judge Cleveland had that testimony before him. That was testimony concerning what happened after the supervised visitation. Was he just to ignore that?
No, I think he's absolutely, he can take that into consideration. Obviously, we disagree with it, but Judge Cleveland's free to consider that testimony. The problem is what Judge Cleveland did with that testimony. He took away virtually all of her visitation and made it supervised. So,
the doctor is saying,
okay,
help the children improve.
But if these are all allegations that the children are markedly improving by Keitha's visitation, on which at the time was on a first, third, and fifth weekend. Secondly, if that is the true issue, why limit the time so extremely? Why not order supervised visitation, but don't cut down the time? Why do you do the super? Why do you cut? You got to look back at the basis of why he allegedly reduced the supervised visitation was because on Keitha's motion for enforcement, Judge Cleveland suspended her visitation.
Well, isn't a judge supposed to do what's in the, isn't the best interest of the children always the overriding factor, no matter what is actually set?
We rely on that every day in our family law case, but you can't overstate it. You should certainly take the best interest of the children, but you certainly, if Mark thought it was such an emergency that required supervised visitation, wouldn't you set your motion for hearing? If you really thought she was killing herself, wouldn't you call 911? Would you wait a couple months? That's where I'm looking at the credibility. Are those real valid factors? Are they so amorphous and so vague that you can just throw innuendos in there, like her being allegedly being prosecuted for dock shopping when there was no evidence of it?
We can't go back and judge the credibility. That's not what we can do.
You can't, but when you tie it, you're exactly right, Justice Gabriel, but what you do is you tie it to what the result was. How does remember, there's a rebuttable presumption that she should have standard. And then if you're going to restrict it, look at what he's done to her. And because they've raised this issue, Justice Gabriel, they raised that the final decree is now moot because Judge Cleveland entered a new order suspending her visitations to 4 hours on a Saturday, when Judge Cleveland ignored the fact he made Keitha Thayer go to trial, final trial, without her lawyer, who was previously set on a criminal matter, on a jury trial. And we all know criminal cases take precedent over civil matters.
It's not on appeal in this case.
It is. They've raised it in the appellee's brief as a basis for mooting my appeal. We said that continuance was mandatory, which it is, and therefore renders that underlying order, we're also appealing that as well, in a sister appeal that y'all will be hearing. But they've raised it as a basis for mooting our appeal here today. And we've said, number one, he didn't even have a valid order of assignment. His order of assignment expired. And two, he makes Keitha Thayer. If that is not also dovetails into why he should have been recused, because we put in Mark Thayer's own testimony that basically the fix is in with Judge Cleveland. He said he's hardcore. All this lady wants, Justice Gabriel, is to see her child. For more than 4 hours. She's never harmed the child. She's never endangered the child. There's no evidence of any harm or endangerment. That's what you do to hardcore criminals. You give them 4 hours who have been in the pen for 5 years. I've never, ever in my 25-year career, having family law appeals and in the trial court, ever seen 4 hours for someone who's never done any type of crime in this situation or hurt the child. If the drug issue was really an issue, why was there not a drug test of Keitha Thayer? Because she's such an abuser of these drugs. I have tons of cases where we have clients being tested weekly if you really thought she was a drug abuser. They're all excuses vaguely thrown out there. A lot of these letters are all, granted they came in by agreement, but they're hearsay letters. Look at Thomas Ratino's pain management letter. The only thing that's even remotely recent is his January 2013 letter, which doesn't refer to any dates. You know what he's heard in the community? Oh, Keitha Thayer. Her lawyer tried to subpoena Dr. Ratino, and then in response got that letter, which says, I think you're abusing. There's not a test result. There's not a date. There's not a time. How do you defend those allegations on a letter that's admitted without a sponsoring or backup?
I want to know what you meant by the fix is in with Judge Cleveland.
Mark Thayer said, we can go back to court. It's in evidence. It's in our reply brief. He said, we can go back to Judge Cleveland, and he's hardcore, and we can go back and get it. And what happened? They went back to court, and she got reduced to 4 hours.
What do you mean by the fix is in with Judge Cleveland?
I am characterizing Mark Thayer's testimonies. He did not say it that way, but he said, Judge Cleveland will basically is hardcore, and if Keitha goes back to court, we'll do okay.
Pretty serious accusation.
I understand.
Fixes in. That's certainly different from.
I apologize.
The judge is predisposed to rule a certain way.
I apologize for that use of the term, Your Honor.
Let me ask a question on the timing of some of these orders, because it appears that many of the orders ultimately were agreed orders. But the one you're arguing about now is the result of the modification based on a motion for protective order. Is that correct?
Well, actually, no, Your Honor. It's arising out of the final decree of divorce.
Okay.
It is. It's leading into giving some of the background. Judge Crawford had entered an order. Then Judge Cleveland, on a motion to modify, reduced her visitation pretrial. Then ultimately culminated in the final decree of divorce. And so I think those are merged into that final decree of divorce. So that's the ultimate order we're appealing. However, and I know we use these terms sometimes, they're the same name for the same motion. They're called motion to modify, or petition to modify. There was a later motion to modify post-trial. That is, we filed a notice of appeal from that one. But that is a basis for mooting the child custody issues based on the final decree, because the order has subsequently been modified.
Modified.
Yes.
Okay.
Then we responded to say, well, we don't think that's true because we believe two things. Judge Cleveland's assignment had expired, and so any order he would have entered would have been void, and two, he should have granted the continuance.
I see. Okay. Thank you. All right, Ms. Hall.
Happy New Year, Justices.
Happy New Year,
Ms. Michelle. May it please the Court. As Judge Crawford correctly observed in his letter preceding his temporary orders, the initial temporary orders in this case is not as complex as portrayed. And on appeal, we see that very same observation continue on. Despite appellant's openings, briefs, emotional pleas, and her reply brief's attempt to introduce new arguments and convolute the issues on appeal have been waived or are not an error, and any error arguably present has either been invited or is harmless. As a threshold matter, appellee asks that the Court recognize and disregard any new arguments that have been brought and raised for the first time in appellant's reply brief, such as there no evidence challenge to appellee's $85,000 right to reimbursement, which for the first time is raised on page 20 of their reply brief, their argument that somehow the agreed-to distribution of the marital home caused or contributed to an unfair division of the property, which is for the first time raised on page 22, and any assertion that the appellee's expert opinion was speculative or conclusory from a substantive standpoint is for the first time raised in their reply brief. Regarding the possession, whether or not the issue of the possession is moot has been recognized, intertwined with the order appealed from in the subsequent modification, which is on appeal here in cause number 14-339-CV. Appellant's brief's deadline was extended to the end of January, and because no brief has yet been filed, appellee is not prepared today to address that order. However, if the Court, out of necessity or convenience, decides to consolidate those appeals in rendering its opinion, we just ask that we have the opportunity to brief and argue that opinion before that opinion is rendered. But even if the issue is not moot, there's ample evidence upon which the Court could have based its discretion, and that evidence supports its discretion. It didn't abuse its discretion in ordering the limited visitation. The evidence supporting the trial court's order is outlined on pages 32 and 33 of appellee's brief. I won't go into all of that unless you have specific questions about it, but key points in that evidence supporting the court's order include an email from the party's oldest daughter outlining the effect of appellant's behavior on not only herself, but on the remaining custodial child, BT. Evidence of appellant's pattern of disruptive behaviors are found in text messages and in appellee's testimony. Pictures and text showing appellant appellant passed out while their youngest child was in her care, and the youngest child's text to the father saying, I can't wake her up, what do I do? And then there's also the testimony of Dr. Bates, which you've also recognized, indicated that the children are flourishing under supervised visitation. So there's more than enough evidence to support the fact that that supervised visitation was warranted and was in the court's discretion based on the evidence before it. With respect to the assertion that there was no recent evidence of drug use or abuse, you've acknowledged the January 13th letter from appellant's doctor. That was her testifying expert at trial. That caused a continuance in the trial date. So had that trial gone forward, there would absolutely be evidence. She can't benefit from something that shows that she, her own testifying expert's withdrawal for the very basis of something very recent that she now says is all untimely evidence. So in terms of the visitation and possession, we believe that the evidence clearly supports that. And unless you have any questions, I'll move on to the other issues. Appellant didn't get to the point of the business valuation, but we feel that this issue is not preserved for appeal. It is, to be preserved, an objection has to be clear enough to give the trial court an opportunity to correct it. Here, they stipulated to the expert's qualifications. They admitted both experts' reports. There was no substantive objection during the expert's testimony. The only objection was one of procedural in terms of leading the witness. And there was no challenge of business valuation in their motion for new trial. The only challenge in the motion for new trial was a challenge to the division of property. And the determination of a business valuation is a very different question from that of the overall division of property. So there's no way to put the court on notice that business valuation was in question from their motion for new trial. And as I've noted before, the first time they argue that from a substantive standpoint that appellee's expert's opinion was conclusory or speculative was in their reply brief. So from a substantive standpoint, we feel that they've waived that argument. From a reliance on avoiding waiver, we don't believe that the case they cite, Arcoma, supports their position. In Arcoma, the Texas Supreme Court looked at an expert's opinion and looked at the situation in which that expert had brought the evidence to trial. In Arcoma, the expert and the Supreme Court recognized the expert had cursory testimony and a demonstrable exhibit. They found that sufficient to support the expert's opinion, didn't find it speculative or conclusory, or just take my word for it type of testimony. Here, you have much more evidence in play. You've got extensive testimony by Appley's expert, and you also have his report, which outlines the factors on which he based his opinion and clearly explains how he reached his conclusions. So there's no way that could be characterized as speculative or conclusory.
Was the only thing that was admitted regarding the business valuation the actual expert reports?
I believe there are also financials in the...
Okay.
But I don't think those were used in the expert's testimony. I think those were the financials that were entered throughout the proceeding of the divorce. You know, every so often, Appley had to enter, you know, the current valuation of his business, and I think those were inputs probably to the expert's opinion, but I don't think either expert actually referred to those documents.
Did anyone submit any kind of agreement between the broker and this agent, the husband?
I would have to go back and look and see if that specific document
okay.
was in
well,
evidence.
Well, we can check the record.
Yeah, I know that Appley's expert said that he reviewed it and that appellant's expert said that he did not. And you know, I also know that Appley's expert has been in the business that Appley has been in. Appellant's expert mischaracterized that business as a broker-dealer when, in fact, he wasn't a broker-dealer. And they use very different methodologies, which is another reason we think the ultimate question here and the challenge they have is on the methodology chosen by Appley's expert and not on his ultimate opinion. And if you look at their opening brief, the only assertion of error that you can take from that is that, well, we don't like the way that he calculated goodwill. That's more of a procedural methodology complaint than that speculative or conclusory. That doesn't come back to light until the reply brief. Does anyone have any questions on valuation? Regarding the education fund, Appley does not in any way concede that the distribution of the award was not proper. Regardless of any alleged waiver asserted in the reply brief, appellant retains the burden to prove that the court erred in its property division and that any individual error resulted in a grossly unfair division overall. And that's a burden that she has not met. at the very core of the issue, appellant asked that that should the fund not be awarded for the use of the children, that it be used to retire community debt. And in this case, appellee got all of the debt that appellant didn't ask for. The only debt that appellant received was debt she specifically asked for. And so she cannot complain on that about that debt on appeal. And it was an error for the court to follow her instruction, or it was invited error, to follow her instruction to use that education fund to retire the debt that appellee received. And so the entire basis for appellant's unfair property division argument was that the business was undervalued and that the education fund, there was error in awarding the education fund. Because those two errors don't exist, there's no unfair distribution of property. Now, we believe that our brief adequately outlines the rest of the issues for the court, and so we don't want to unnecessarily take the court's time. So we're prepared to stand on our briefing for any of the remaining issues, unless you all have some questions for us. Okay, thank you, y'all.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. Mr. Michelle.
I didn't get a chance to get to the disproportionate award, so I'll try to get to that very quickly. If you look at their brief on pages 46 and 47 and 48, they prepare a chart. In that chart, they indicate at the top of it that the house was agreed to be awarded to Mark and sold. What they don't put on there is the value, that the net value that they were awarded. Mark was. Mark testified at trial he would net out approximately $70,000 from the sale of the house, which would also then take out the Chase mortgage debt of $154,000 because it's net of the mortgage. Mark testified that. And then take that $70,000 to reduce that IRS debt from $103,000 to approximately $30,000. So on their own chart, they overstated the amount of the debt by Mark by their own exhibit, taking their values of Thayer and Associates at $27,000. They overstated it by approximately $220,000. That's on their side of the table. If you do that and take their chart on their numbers and just properly including the house, Mark is awarded $115,000 in debt, and both sides agree to the amount of debt that Keitha had relatively closely. They're about $25,000 apart, between $276,000 and $291,000 on Keitha's side. So good enough for government work on my side, the way I do the math. But that's roughly $300,000, $100,000, just ballparking it. 70-30 divide in favor of Mark. Mark makes $250,000 a year, $240,000 a year, and Keitha was awarded spousal support for 12 months by Judge Cleveland. I think on those set of facts alone, that is by definition an unfair division of the estate, especially when you consider the MRF factors, the abilities of the parties, the earning capacity of the parties. Judge Cleveland didn't find any fault in the marriage, for the breakup of the marriage, and also found that she was entitled to support. On the fund, Judge Cleveland found the deferred compensation, which Mark testified at trial, was community income. It was earned through his efforts. It was put in through a deferred compensation plan. Judge Cleveland effectively divested the parties of that community property and awarded it to the children. And depending how the court wants to look at that, because the actual discussion of the deferred compensation fund is not in the award of the marital property, which you see at the end of the decree, typically property awarded to the husband, property awarded to the wife, debt to the husband, debt to the wife. It's not in that section. It's on page 8 and 9. Page 9 and 10 of the brief, and where the court finds that the deferred compensation count is really a custodial account and that it's going to be limited to use for the education of the children. He's basically transformed a community asset into a ward for the children. He made a finding of gift, but there's no evidence of a gift at all. Keitha said it wasn't a gift. It was in a deferred compensation account. It was not in a TUGMA account. It wasn't delivered. So none of the elements of a gift were met. If you add that $132,000 error into the mix, that adds the compounding of the error of the disproportionate award on those things. With regard to the waiver issues about how somehow Keitha invited this, that's really a red herring. She's talking about taking some certain debts, as we all do, in the overall scope of a marital property division. She certainly didn't anticipate not getting any of the assets. She got a car. She got a car out of the divorce. So when you look at the overall division of the property, you can't just pick and choose certain assets and say that particular item is an invited heir. It's what we do in our property proposals. I suggest I'll take that debt. As long as he takes that debt, I get this asset, you get that asset. But you can't just say, oh, you said you'd take that debt, and you get all these debts, and we give nothing else of what you requested as well. So that's a red herring. Finally, I want to clarify and apologize to the court, Justice Dofano, if I overstated that. I think that was the feeling of what my client was feeling, Mark was thinking at the time. It was a very heated incident. At the time, a child was being picked up by the police. It was a heated statement made by Mark. My client felt, or took that as feeling like Mark felt like he could go back to court. If I said it inappropriately or incorrect, I apologize to the court, and I overspoke or I misspoke. So I wanted to apologize and clarify that to the court. Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Michelle, Ms. Hall. We appreciate everybody's briefing in this matter and your arguments today. Your case is now submitted. And